mostly fermion systems.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I'm talking only about fermion systems. Thank you. And I'm going to be basically talking about the problem which has caused a great deal of both theoretical and experimental interest over the last 6 months or so, which is the question of how, as you tune the magnetic field through a Fechsbach resonance, you cross over from what you might imagine might be a weakly interacting BCS type system to a compact Bose condensate of diatomic molecules. Now, I should say right away that apart from maybe the last 5%, there really isn't anything that's new in this talk, in the sense that everything I'm going to say, I think, has been by now realised by various people, including in particular Jason, I think, in his recent preprint, certainly has most of this. Probably one or two other preprints that have come out recently also do. I am going to be approaching it in a slightly different language from the way that most of these papers have approached it. Most of these papers assume that when you're on the so-called BEC side of the Fechsbach resonance, you have a tightly bound diatomic molecule whose structure is more or less insensitive to many-body effects. I'm going to actually work explicitly in the language of fermions all along, so I won't write down any operators which are specifically associated with diatomic molecules. One reason I think this is it's a good idea to do this is that, as we'll see, I think this is something which I think is doesn't seem to be totally said very explicitly in much of the existing literature. It's very tempting to think that you've got a diatomic molecule state sitting there and you've got a some kind of scattering or open channel state sitting there, and that the two are hybridizing. That's actually not right, at least it's not right for much of the regime we're going to be talking about. For much of the regime we're going to be talking about, the diatomic molecule, that is the what I'm going to call the closed channel state, doesn't really exist in any meaningful sense. And I think that using the fermion language and using coordinate space language directly may help one to get that firmly in the front of one's mind. Okay, so I don't have to remind you about the general setup. Fechsbach resonance occurs when we have some so-called open channel that we're principally interested in. This is given by the blue potential curve here. And that has some kind of threshold energy at infinity, which we take as the zero of energy. And then you tune the magnetic field so that there is a second channel, the so-called closed channel, in which there's a particular bound state setting, and you tune the magnetic field so that the continuum at infinity for the open channel crosses with the bound state in the closed channel. And then you expect interesting things to happen, and that's exactly what's been done in experiments over the last few months. I'm going to work in real space. I'm not going to use any kind of delta function potential. I'm going to use real potential. I'm going to use real potential for the open channel, a real potential for the closed channel, and a real interchannel coupling, which will have some strength G and then some shape factor F of R, which has a cutoff L0 here. I'm going to assume that it has some kind of reasonable cutoff, which is not much larger than the radius of the state in the closed channel. So I'm going to treat these two as roughly of the same order of magnitude, although we could, of course, do things more generally. And one very important assumption I'm going to make all along is that the closed channel radius, that's roughly this here, is much smaller than the mean distance between particles, roughly kF to the minus 1. So that's one fundamental assumption I'm always going to be making throughout, although we'll see at the end that we do have to worry about the first corrections when this is not quite the case. A second assumption I'm going to make purely for the purposes of order of magnitude estimates is that the background open channel scattering length is neither very large nor very small compared to this typical radius. So basically I have three lengths here which I'm going to assume are of the same order of magnitude, namely the closed channel radius, this quantity L0, which basically is the cutoff of the interchannel coupling, and the background open channel scattering length. Now, as I say, again, we could generalize things beyond that quite easily. It's just that the order of magnitude estimates just get a bit more messy, so that's why I keep it this way. And I'm finally going to assume, this is a fairly fundamental assumption, that the strength of the interchannel coupling is small compared to the binding energy of the resonant state in the closed channel.
So you are now considering mid-2-pi.
I'm just coming to that. Okay. Basically, what I'm going to try to do in this talk is to just try to give you a qualitative picture of what the crossover behavior, say, qualitatively looks like in the presence of a Feshbach resonance. And let me emphasize again that the formal results I'm getting, I don't think go beyond what are already in the literature, but I think this way of looking at things, it may be helpful. And incidentally, right at the end, we will come to a point where I think you can use this as a jumping off point for something a bit more interesting, well, a bit not more interesting, but more novel perhaps. Okay, so what I'm going to do is, first of all, discuss very briefly.
Just a small clarification. So the last condition that the coupling is smaller than the binding energy of closed channel.
Yeah. Well, you see, for a start,
I get confused in notations.
That saves me from having to consider other bound states in the closed channel, etc. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to start off with a very brief discussion of the single channel case for the two-body problem, which is a sort of trivial textbook problem, but just to sort of get some notation established and so forth and remind you of one or two important things. Then go on to the single channel case, the many-body problem, that was the subject which has been of interest now for 30 years or so, and there's a whole lot of literature on that. Then go to the Feshbach resonance case for the two-body problem, because I do think that we need to have a good feeling for what's going on in the two-body problem before we go to the many-body problem, and then finally come to the crunch, which is the real meat of the talk.
Can you explain again what your condition G much less than
spontaneous? Basically, well, this has several functions.
Delta mu times B, right?
Sorry? That's right. Yes. That's right. Yes. Yeah. So it saves us from having to consider either other bound states or the continuum in the closed channel, among other things. It does. It's essential for various other reasons too. But the prime thing is that it saves us to do that. Okay.
What aspect? I mean, what in a physical system? What's going to help me see what the get that limit in the end?
Well, let's see. Let's think about the actual physical mechanisms of the coupling. I mean, typically, when they do these experiments, they're starting off from an open channel. They're basically, most of these experiments are done in the high field regime or pressure back regime, where to a first approximation you have an electron spin which can be up or down, and then you have your nuclear spin which can flop around. And most of these experiments start in the lower state, that is in the state in which the electron spins are both parallel in the two colliding atoms, and the Feshbach resonance, the closed channel, is the one in which one of the electron spins has been reversed. Okay, now let's ask what would be the form of the coupling between the two channels, and I guess crudely I have to admit this is not something I've been into in great detail, but I would assume that the most important in this limit, the most important interchannel coupling, is coming from the fact that you have not. You cannot factorize things into electron triplet and electron singlet exactly because of the hyperfine interaction. So, a simpler answer to the question of why it's reasonable to believe this, as it were, is that, as we'll see, things like the width of the resonance depend on this quantity, and if the resonance is narrow enough, then you certainly know that's fulfilled.
But narrow resonance, it's really singlet. Closed channel belongs to the same system. But for wide resonance,
yep.
The closed channel is treatment.
Is that right? Okay. Well, fine. I understand. Okay. Yes. I have to admit, this is not a detail. It's very important. But one has to get it right if one's going to analyze real experiments.
G is proportional to the hyperfine constant. So G is of the order of 10 gigahertz.
I think it's actually, yes.
That's because S1, S2 is zero there, close to zero. S1 minus S2.
I think what I'm going to rely on is that at least for some of the, this condition, you can be sure that this condition will be satisfied, I guess. Now I think I've got this right. If the width of the resonance is small compared to the absolute value delta mu b, which it usually is in practice. So.
question.
Yeah.
You said that epsilon naught is the same as delta mu b. I said
yeah, because that's conditioned for resonance. That's conditioned to be at or close to the Fishbein resonance.
That's how you define epsilon naught is equal to delta mu b.
Well, sure, but the physical interpretation is that it's the energy of the bound state in the closed channel, the binding energy.
I was thinking it's a shift meter, slightly different.
Well, okay, I mean, look, all I'm saying is that you want to be close to the condition where zero is. Okay, you want to be near the resonance. Okay. Okay, so some very brief reminders about the sort of textbook, trivial textbook case, single channel case near a potential resonance. Okay, so you basically are talking about a situation where you have some potential which you imagine you can tweak with some kind of knob, and depending on how you tweak the knob, either you've got a bound state just below threshold or you've got a state which is not quite bound, a resonance, I mean just above threshold. And if you imagine you have some kind of control parameter like the overall strength or potential, we'll come back in a moment to a realistic definition of this. But as you tune this, you see that as you come up from this side from below, the S wave scattering length, this is a zero energy scattering length, goes off to positive infinity, comes back from negative infinity here, and of course you have this bounce on this side only. On this side only, you have this bound state sitting here, which has a radius, it has an energy given by this, a radius given by A sub B, and A sub B is not, I suppose this is a sort of trivial statement, it's something very basic. A sub B, the radius of the bound state, is numerically equal to, apart from sine, it's equal, without the sine, to the S wave scattering length here. Remember, AS goes as minus 1 over delta, so AS is positive here, and it's numerically equal to AB. And so that statement sounds trivial. It's obviously trivial in the single channel case, but it wasn't quite so trivial in the two channel case. Okay, now there's a bit of technology which one wants to go through very briefly here. Again, just essentially to set up the notation. Write our Schrödinger wave function for the two particles as a function of relative coordinate in terms of its Fourier expansion. And here you have your Hamiltonian here, and with your normalization given by that. And now there's a nice little trick which is quite convenient for this kind of problem. Remember, we're going to be interested here in the case where I'm very close to resonance, when AS is very large compared to the radius of the bound state. Compared to the sort of typical radius of the potential here. Okay. Not compared to the radius of the bound state, that is what it is. Okay, so we introduce a cutoff in momentum space, which basically is the inverse of some length, which is large compared to the range of the potential, but small compared to the scattering length. And then you do a standard renormalization trick, which is done any number of times in different notation. You renormalize your potential by taking full account of the scattering at large momenta, that is larger than this QC here. And this is technically the way of doing it. You can choose not particularly interesting. What is interesting is that at the end of the day, you emerge with an effective low energy scattering potential, which is independent of K and K prime, its indices, but is a function of the cutoff here. I think this is not a sort of the most standard way of doing things, but I think it's a rather convenient way for our purposes. Moreover, this U that you've defined, although technically it contains E here, as long as E is small compared to this value here, basically E drops out of this formula. So you can do this. And then having done that, you get a slightly simpler form for the Hamiltonian here, where you've just got your kinetic energy, and now your potential energy is rather nice and simple because it's got this term here. But of course, this does occur depending on the cutoff. And your renormalization has to be, this should be a sum prime over k, that is a sum over k less than the cutoff. So that's a nice compact low energy form. And now you can just solve your Schrödinger equation, and lo and behold, what comes out is that the coefficients for the of the relative wave function come out to be this expression here, and lo and behold, it turns out that this expression is actually independent of the cutoff because of this factor here, and it comes out to be just some u0 divided by 2ek, And by comparing the coordinate space forming the wave function that you've written down with the standard 1 minus AS over R, you make the standard identification here. Okay.
Why do you say it's independent of QC?
Sorry?
Why?
You can, okay, it's not immediately obvious. Suppose that we take a given QC, write down this expression, and then redo our renormalization, going to a lower value QC. It turns out that this particular combination is always invariant. So I'm just saying that you can always effectively define, I guess this we normally call the zero energy two matrix, but you can always define that quantity consistently. Okay. The one thing I'd just like to, although this is probably very standard, I assume this trick is standard, though I haven't sort of written quite a textbook for it. I'd like to just go through this argument very briefly, because it's a simpler example of something I'm going to be doing later, which is slightly less trivial. Okay. From now on, whenever I say psi of r, or chi of r, it's actually chi of r, I guess, here, I'm always going to mean the radial wave function, which means that I've taken out this factor of r to the minus 1, and if I was consistent, I'd probably take out a factor of root 4 pi or something of the kind, I guess, which I haven't always bothered to do. But anyway, so this is the, as it were, the one-dimensional radial wave function, which obeys a one-dimensional Schrodinger equation. Okay, what we'd like to do is to produce an explicit formula near the resonance for the S-wave scattering length in terms of delta, my tuning parameter, which I'm going to be basically regarding as the departure of the potential from the critical value, which gives you the exact onset of the bound state. Okay, well, quite generally, from very general considerations from the solution of Schrödinger's equation, we know that in the long wavelength, in the limit where r is large compared to the range of the potential, so there's no potential there, but small compared to AS, then the wave function can always be written in this general form. Basically, that just follows because it's the only solution of Laplace's equation which is valid in that region. Now, if VC of R is the critical value, so that AS goes to infinity here, then the chi zero, the appropriate wave function associated with that critical value, satisfies this equation here. Now, if we now change the potential slightly, then the zero energy solutions now satisfy this this modified equation here. And now we just go through a standard trick. We multiply this equation by chi, not chi zero, multiply this one by chi zero. We subtract the two, we use Green's theorem, and moreover, we use the fact that both of these quantities, because remember they're the regularly reduced ones, they have to go to zero for r goes to zero. Okay, and so at the end of the day, we come out with this formula here, where this is the derivative of evaluated at this point r, any point r, which is somewhere in this regime. Doesn't matter which point. Okay, and so this simply comes out to be as to minus one. Since the potentials are very close, the wave functions must also be very close in this regime, and therefore we have the simple formula that the inverse of the scattering length is simply given by this formula here, this being normalized to go to 1 minus AS over R at in the appropriate regime. And this, and we can then take this as our tuning parameter. As I say, the only reason, I mean, I'm sure, as I say, this is a very standard trick. The only reason I've gone through it is because we're going to do something similar, but a bit more complicated later on. Okay. So this, incidentally, does assure us something we knew, but nice to have it explicit, that that AS does indeed go as minus one of the delta. Okay, now for the slightly less trivial, still fairly well known, the many-body problem in the single-channel case. We can make a naive ansatz for the wave function, which is guaranteed. Now, as I emphasise, this is only a naive ansatz. It's guaranteed to give us the right results at the BCS end, because it is simply the BCS ansatz at that end. It's also guaranteed to give us, rather trivially, the correct results in the BDC end. In between, we don't know how good it is. My own, as I think I've said before, my own feeling is that it's a sort of reasonable starting point in the same sense as the free Fermi gas is a reasonable starting point for Landau-Fermi liquid theory. You're certainly going to get quantitative corrections to it, but hopefully the general sort of topological structure won't change very much. Now, I'm going to, of course, well, I could then just go through all the standard BCS technology and the usual notation, etc. I would like to do it just slightly differently, because in a slightly different notation, because of a point which is going to come up later. So what I would like to do is to introduce the this quantity here, and its Fourier transform here, which is just what is usually called the pair wave function in BCS theory. And this is really, in some sense, the most fundamental quantity describing your state in BCS theory. It is the quantity which is most like a two-particle wave function. You can do things differently. You can write down a nasty slater determinant or a slater determinant type structure of things which look like two-particle wave functions, but then they turn out to have rather horrendously complicated properties in general. So this is really the thing that looks most like the two-particle wave function in the BCS problem. And now, let me write down an expression for my kinetic energy and my potential energy. Well, the nice thing about this quantity is that in terms of the potential energy, apart from the Hartree term, which for the single channel case, the Hartree term should be essentially negligible. It's not so obvious it's going to be negligible in the two channel case, but let's neglect it for the single channel case. Apart from that, the expectation value of the potential simply has this very nice form here, which is just like a standard two-particle expression. The kinetic energy is a bit more complicated, because you have to remember that you can't put more than one particle per state since you're dealing with fermions, and that's basically the reason why this expression gets a little more complicated. And it has this form here, which is probably a bit unfamiliar, but it's equivalent to something you all know and love. And then you can start expanding this, and so forth. Now, you see, if you just scrap all these higher order terms, then the structure you have for the total energy is exactly the same as you would have in the two-particle problem, with fk simply replacing the Fourier components of the wave function. Okay, that's what's nice about this. I think this particular notation. Now, provided, okay, so we're now looking at the real problem near a resonance. Provided that all the fk's for k greater than q cutoff are much less than one. Then basically the renormalization procedure is exactly the same as it was for the two-particle problem. And so we get out this renormalized expression for the energy, where we have, again, as in the two-particle problem, a U of QC. But you see it's not quite the same as the two-particle problem because of this factor here. Well, now, I mean, at this point it gets a bit clumsy to go on with this notation. We can introduce the standard BCS notation by making these definitions here. And going through all the standard technology, we get the BCS equation, the gap equation, which we can write with a constant. It turns out that the gap in this limit, the gap in the low momentum range, is just a constant, because basically this is just a constant. And we can write the gap equation in this form. And now, having eliminated, you remember that we had a relation between U of QC and U0, which in turn was related to the S-wave scattering length, so we can eliminate this in favor of AS. And we get this by now fairly well-known equation, which says that which is just this here. So this is the form of the BCS gap equation for the single-channel resonance problem, okay? This is not enough. We've got a chemical potential mu occurring in here, and in principle at least we have to have another equation to determine the chemical potential. And that in fact is going to be the particle number conservation equation, but I haven't written it out yet. Okay. Now, I do want you to notice one rather trivial looking fact, which is going to be rather important later. If you look at the coordinate space form of your pair wave function, in this region, this intermediate region, large compared to the range of the potential, small compared to the scattering length, and all other characteristic lengths of the problem, then in fact the form, the structure of that is exactly the same as the single particle problem. The normalization is proportional to the gap here. Okay? Let's say that it looks like a rather trivial statement, but it will be useful. Okay. So we can go and go through all this technology then. As I said, we had two unknowns, namely the chemical potential and the gap. And these are determined by two equations. One is the gap equation, which I wrote down before on the last view graph. The other one I didn't write down, but it's just the particle number conservation equation. And it looks like that. And if you stare at those equations and do a bit of appropriate scaling, you can easily figure out that there's only one dimensionless variable which controls this problem, which is KFAS, or beta 1 minus 1 over KFAS. Let me take this occasion to make one more plea that this community, that is the community of people interested in Feshbach resonances, decides which way round they want this graph. It's very confusing because people sometimes put it the other way around. I think I'd rather, somehow I like this way around because I guess I'm used to it.
So the molecules are
maybe have a vote.
What sign is your scattering length if you have a hard sphere?
If I have a hard sphere. Oh, yeah. Well, if I have a hard sphere, then the scattering length is positive and is the radius of the sphere. However, let me emphasize that you really can't, all this is meaningless for hard spheres, because it's
I want to know the side of your side dimension.
Yeah, okay, fine. So this side is, this is negative scattering length out here, you see. Very small negative scattering length is way off here. That means BCS, basically you're in BCS limit. You get very weakly bound pairs. The chemical potential is essentially equivalent to the Fermi energy. AS is going exponentially to zero here. Now, on this side, you have a delta is negative, so AS is positive, right? So in the two-particle problem, you would get a bound state on this side. And now this probably, I probably haven't got this quantitative right, it's just meant to be qualitative. On that side, what happens is that the chemical potential switches over gradually and eventually goes to minus h bar squared over 2 MAS squared, which is just the value it would have for the two-particle problem. Meanwhile, the gap is actually doing something like this. It is increasing down here, but only rather slowly, in fact.
Yeah, I also hope that you use this notation, because I think that's closest to its mental situation, but it would be all in exactly the same way.
Yes.
What notation?
Well, I mean, it's mentally, I mean, you look at what it's mental data, really, is a fermion on the one side, on this side, molecules on the other side.
So this is, this would be high field. That'd be high field in the actual physical case. Yep.
So how is this exactly what Randeria did? I mean, what you have up here, this is the same.
Eagles did it in 1969, I did it in 1980, Randeria did it in 1985.
What Randeria in his article does is, I mean, he converts it in terms of scattering length. So, and maybe this is some previous article, I don't know. But, I mean, he just puts it in, basically translates it into an atomic context.
Well, I mean, here is a scattering length.
So where are the fluctuations?
There aren't any fluctuations. Not at least in the sense in which StatMech people usually think of fluctuations. I mean, I think the word fluctuation is a bit ambiguous. And in fact, I got a bit confused by, there's an article by, I think, Murray Holland and a few other people a year or two ago, which said that they had taken into account fluctuations. I think what they actually meant is they'd taken into account finite temperature effects.
They meant the normal anomalies.
Yeah.
Maybe they call finite temperature effects.
Yeah, well, let me emphasize that all this is the most naive mean field theory. It's just the, in the BCS limit, it's simply BCS, it's just a generalization of that. But we want to get a feeling for the general structure rather than the quantitative details at this point.
But you're not getting to a constant on the other side, is that right? I'm just trying to understand this red line here.
It's going as AS to the minus a half, because delta is basically controlled by the total normalization of the state.
When
Gilbert
did his work and people asked, he said, what
only do you
do?
Well, I was going to say, Eagles have done it anyway.
Gilbert has shown is that he has analyzed the phase fluctuations of this state, and he has discovered at t equals zero, is that at least this state is always stable. And the finite temperature, the fluctuation is getting larger and larger, at least at this slope is negative.
Yeah, so the vertical line is the position of Fischbach resonance?
Yes, yeah. Well, this is not a Fischbach resonance, no, this is a potential resonance, but it's the position of the resonance, yes.
The position. Scattering lengths are all negative in this...
Scattering length is negative on this side, positive on this side.
If you're positive, why you have this less scattering?
You don't. No, BC is appearing here, on the negative side.
But yeah, but we have a molecule.
So when I'm far enough down this curve, okay. Then basically what I've got is just a simple Bose condensate of diatomic molecules,
right,
at least to a first approximation.
I guess I still find this is a very remarkable. I think for people, but that, there are many questions from people from the area so kind of of the same sort of material. I think we have seen the crossover theory of Tungian is often now it seems coming through. But then if you just look at the effective Tungian, the delta function, and the positive G. on the other side, and then every textbook will tell you that, well, it's a normal fermion liquid. But the answer is no, all the textbooks are not correct. There's a better state sitting down there, which is a molecular state. So the fixed point is not a fermion liquid fixed point, it's a molecular state. It's a molecular
function. It's a different model, right?
No, exactly. So if you look at the function effective Hamiltonian, at the face value, is exactly the same. And McGalka has had bound states there, usually in the condition.
Okay, there's one thing I think it's easy to forget, at least for many body people, it's easy to forget, which is that you can't realistically, in an atomic system of real atoms, you can't realistically turn your potential up to arbitrarily large positive values without having a bound state sitting there. Okay, where are we? Sorry, where have I got to? Fischbach resonance, two-body. Yes, I think I got through everything I wanted to on that one. Yep. I did show you this one. Yes. Okay. Now let's come to the third part of the talk, which is the two-body problem near a Fischbach resonance. And this is, I guess, by now pretty well standard. But never, again, it's worth just going through it to get some kind of feeling for what's going on. I'm going to always mean, by chi of r, the open channel amplitude with the factor of r to minus 1 taken out. There is an implicit approximation made in the first stage of this calculation, namely that the only state in the closed channel we need to worry about is this single state which is near resonance. So we don't have to worry about other excited resonance state, we don't have to worry about the continuum. That was the point of that assumption that g is much small enough. Okay, that's true, hopefully that's true. That's right. So we can eliminate the closed channel state completely in this approximation, and we get an effective integral differential Schrodinger equation for the open channel state. And now the interesting thing about this, of course, is that it does contain this resonant denominator down here. And k of r and r prime is simply some known function which is given in terms of the closed channel eigenfunctions and the coupling strength f here. Let me emphasize, for the two-body problem, with this approximation of only one resonant state in the closed channel, this is exactly this result. Now, there will exist some value, delta zero of delta, which is actually of this order of magnitude here. And now, from my, remember that I had all my sort of short lengths of the same order of magnitude, this quantity here is really just about the bound state energy in order of magnitude. So this quantity delta zero is of order g squared divided by epsilon zero, and is then therefore.
I understand. So this equation is that I eliminate one on the channel and then go simply to the closed.
You simply write down the Schrodinger equation for the closed channel amplitude, solve it, stick it in there. Yep, this is simple. Yep. Okay. So this now means that the delta zero, which in some sense is going to be one characteristic energy, not the most important one, but it's one characteristic energy of the problem, is going to be small compared to the delta mu b. Okay. Now, as we can work this argument backwards, if we know experimentally that this is true, then we can conclude that g was small compared to epsilon zero. Let chi zero be the critical value of the eigenfunction, that is the one at which a new bound state exactly appears. Then you can go through the same maneuver as you did for the two-body case. And I showed you explicitly in the two-body case, simply so avoid having to show you explicitly in the many-body case. Okay, but you can see that it works exactly the same. And moreover, you can do it for a finite eigenvalue E, which will be useful for future purposes. And at the end of that calculation, what comes out is this result here, which is exact, again, within this approximation. Turns out, this is an integral only as far as R, which remember is something kind of intermediate length. In the regime we're interested in, it turns out this term can be neglected because it's down by a factor of R of AS relative to the terms you keep. Moreover, we can now evaluate this quantity here. And we evaluate it in terms of the A which occurs in the wave function chi, which we're looking for. Now, let me emphasize that in general, A is not equal now to the S wave scattering amplitude. There's a nice point that comes in here. If you have a single channel problem, then the radius of the bound state must inevitably be equal to the zero energy scattering amplitude. Why? Simply because you need to make the two functions orthogonal, and that limit, that gives you that result. In the two-channel problem, where you've got your closed channel sitting there, you don't necessarily have to make the components within the open channel identical, orthogonal to one another. So it's not guaranteed a priori that this is actually AS for any state that you want, any relevant state you want to consider.
As you tune the resonance, do they approach each other?
Yes, we'll see if they do. Yes.
Isn't that true in the other case too? I mean,
that's true. So, yeah, but you see, yeah, okay, you've got...
become equal at the resonant point, and what is different here?
Well, I mean, I guess it's formally different in the sense that, at least prima facie, you've got these two completely independent channels. You don't just have some kind of wiggles in your overall potential, as it were. So these two channels, remember, in general correspond to different spin states. We'll come back to that point. But it's a matter of taste, I guess, whether you say it's sort of qualitatively different or not. But we'll see that that in a region which is still interesting from our point of view, the structure of this quantity A may be more complicated than it is very close to the resonance in the one-body problem. Okay. If you like, what's really happening, I think, is that when you're in a typical one channel case, the order of magnitude of the distance you've got to go in energy away from your resonance to get qualitatively different behavior is the distance of the spacing between the actual levels. In this case, it can be much smaller than that. And in fact, it can even, as we'll see, it can even be comparable to the Fermi energy, which is a many body parameter. Yeah. So, we will make
the
drop. Yes.
Just for the correct,
yes.
So in the one channel case, in the single channel case, the bond state and the free pairs, they are in the same spin channel.
Yes. Yes.
And then when you approach this infinite negative scattering, the BCS gap goes to.
No, the BCS gap stays perfectly finite. It's of the order of the Fermi energy at that point. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you mean in the same speed channel?
Oh, by the definition of the single channel case, the spins sort of are just fall out. I mean, they're just, you start off with a particular pair of states, and then you just tune somehow. You turn a knob and tune the ordinary potential.
This is a model, yes. In practice, this bound state channel is of different spin from the
equation. Well, that's right. We're coming to it. We're coming to that point. Yeah. Okay. So another important point in looking at this equation is that we are going to actually be interested. Delta zero, incidentally, turns out to be essentially the shift of the point where the resonance occurs relative to the point where the uncoupled levels cross. So it's a sort of energy offset, as it were. And we're going to be interested, actually, always in values of delta, and therefore, as we'll see, values of E, which are small compared to this. So we can basically scrub this in the denominator here. Moreover, in this term here, again, we're going to be working very close to the resonance where chi of R, the actual solution, looks indistinguishable from chi zero of R in the short-range regime.
Which term can I ignore? You mean
You ignore this one. Secondly, you can cross this out by respect to the delta zero squared. And the reason for that is that we're going to be, as it were, is going to be a higher order than this. Yeah. Okay. And finally, as I say, we can make this approximation here, and it's useful to have it in this form here for a reason you'll see later. This is some quantity which has dimensions of length, which we'll call L sub zero. And it's crudely speaking, it's the range of this coupling function f of r within a factor of order one. This quantity is positive, yes, definitely. Yeah, that's right, that's important, yes. So that gives you some control over, the sign of the effects which come in. Okay, we take this this normalization, and as I say, A is not necessarily going to be the S wave scattering length. And we find this result for A. This just comes. It's just the appropriate approximation to this equation here. And in particular, for E equals zero, the scattering state, no matter where you are, provided you're within this small range specified, then A is minus some positive constant divided by delta. So at least within this range, this is AS is by definition the zero energy scattering state in the open channel, state in the open channel. That is always given by this formula here, no matter where we are within this regime.
Is this just a shorthand for the scattering amplitude? Is that just a shorthand for the scattering amplitude as a function of energy?
It's defined by this equation here. Okay, that's the definition of AOE. It's not in general, as we'll see, if E now denotes a bound state with finite negative energy, then A of E is not necessarily equal to the S wave zero energy scattering length. This is an important point.
Could you please repeat the statement that A over E, what is the statement?
The statement is that I can always define, for any state which is within the general region I'm considering, I can always define a length A by this formula here. However, now in the one-channel case, if I were talking, say, about the single bound state, okay, then the A which occurred here for the bound state would be exactly the S wave scattering length. In general, in the Feshbach case, it's not necessary in this case, as we'll see.
Well, at very large distances it is.
Say?
At
very large distances it turns out not to be. It's a short distance. What do you mean distances? Sorry. Distance is a real space, or?
A two-particle problem.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
In the two-particle problem, what you are actually considering here is nothing else than the resonance on the so-called quasi-discrete level. Yes. You have a quasi-discrete state, and you have this scattering. That's what it is. And then what people were writing over time is the scattering amplitude. Yes. And then it turns out that the amplitude of the S wave scattering, it's there. And then if I write down the expression for the wave function at large distances, I simply write down the scattering terms. And the scattering phase and scattering amplitude,
But we're not considering that situation. We're comparing a bound state, the bound state with the scattering state.
What is the bound state?
We're going to see. We're going to see. There is a
chi of r a scattering wave function of energy E.
That's right. It's the open channel component of. I said that wrong. It's the chi of r is any component of a wave function in the open channel. Now, it may be a scattering state, it may be a bound state, okay? And I think I'm correct. You could be correct in the sense that this could have funny behavior if I go far enough out, but if I stick here, then in general this formula is exact, and we'll see that it does not give something which is equal to the zero.
I simply interrupt you.
Okay, I think you'll see, I think you will see how this point comes out, actually.
Can you show though that is not equal to the scattering amplitude?
I believe I will, yes.
I would guess the scattering amplitude also has precisely the same form, the first order E minus delta.
Yeah. Well, okay.
The higher orders can differ.
This formula applies to everything, to any kind of state. It applies to a scattering state, it applies to a bound state.
Yeah,
just that you have to put in.
It's just the R matrix element, actually. It's one of the R matrix. So for bound state and
quite likely, yes.
And scattering state, it's the same when you cross the resonance.
It's the same in the one channel case.
Yeah.
It's not obviously the same in the two channel case.
Yeah, exactly. So that means that expansion is a bound state wave function for small R topological.
Well, say. Under these conditions here. That's it.
Yeah.
Well, okay, look, I mean, these things are probably very well known in a different notation, so let me not spend too much time on them. But there is one important quantity which I want to introduce. As I said, we did find our car. I shouldn't have put an S on this, I should have put a B for bound state, actually. Sorry, that's a mistake. We saw that the actual low energy S wave scattering length was always exactly proportional to 1 over delta. This quantity here is given by this formula, and if E is not is not zero, then in general it's going to be different. That result came out. You remember how that we got that? We got that simply by solving the two-particle Schrödinger equation and doing appropriate maneuvers with it and using Green's theorem and so forth. Get that out. Okay. So that entirely came from the short from the short-range part of the behavior.
Can you remind me again the definition of delta naught again? Is it related to the bound state?
Delta naught is essentially g squared divided by epsilon zero, where epsilon zero is the absolute value of the bound state energy.
How does that equation differ from the one on the previous transparency?
It doesn't. That's repeated. Yes. So now, okay. Important point. That's one equation for AS as a function of E, but you don't know what E is, so you don't know how to solve it in general. On the other hand, once we're outside the range where anything interesting is going on, that is where both the potential and also the cross-channel coupling has vanished, then we know that the potential is zero, and therefore we have a very a trivial form of Schrödinger's equation, and the energy must be related to AS by this formula here. So if we combine those two equations, we can get an equation for a rather nice simple quadratic equation for E, which is given by this formula, where this very important parameter, delta sub C, it's appropriate to sub C because I think Eric Cornell is the person who's really emphasized this most strongly in recent times. This parameter here basically controls the dependence of the energy on delta. And so this is, in some sense, the really physical quantity which comes out. And I guess it has, let me just say right away, that very often people don't actually use this explicitly. What they do is to use a length which is related to this, which I've defined, I think, somewhere down here, with a bit of luck, maybe on the next view graph. A length xi c, sometimes called r star, I think, which is this. This will have a very simple physical significance, as we'll see in a moment. Okay. We get the simple quadratic formula here, where we can solve that and get this formula here. And now we find the following. When delta is large compared to delta C, then the expectation, the absolute value of the energy, remember the energy is negative, it's bound, then E is simply equal to delta for the first approximation. When delta is much less than delta C, on the other hand, E is proportional to delta squared, not to delta. So this, if you like, so in this regime, things are behaving exactly as they do in the single channel case, but in this case, it's different, and we'll see in a moment what the physical significance of that is.
In the language of this delta C, I'm more used to R star.
R star, okay.
The uppercase is wide resonance, and the lowercase is narrow, or the other way around?
I'll come to that point in a moment, but let me emphasize strongly, because I think this is something which has got a bit confused in recent months, the classification of resonances as broad or narrow is really, to my mind, a completely confusing, because whether because the qualitative behavior in the many, first of all, it doesn't make any difference. I mean, the distinction is meaningless in the two-body problem. It's only in the many-body problem that makes a difference. And what you have to do then is to find another energy to compare with delta C, namely the Fermi energy. Okay, so it's not broad or narrow. It's not a characteristic of the resonance itself. It's a characteristic of the particular many-body system in interacting with the resonance.
Yes,
and we'll see that.
No, I disagree with this statement. Yeah. If you are exactly at resonance, yeah, yes, then this statement is correct. You have to involve the Fermi energy, and there is no way out. But please go away from resonance to the mm-hmm. positive side.
Okay.
Then, where you have these weakly bound molecules and so on. And then, in the universal case, where you can universally express everything through the two-body scattering length A, you have a requirement that R star, it's our R star, R star should be much smaller than A. Yes, and this is, and this does not involve any Fermi energy.
Paraphrase what I think you just said. It's true for this two-body problem. I have this characteristic energy delta C, and I can either be working at detunings large or small compared to that,
yeah,
and depending on which I'm doing, then the behavior is qualitatively quite
yes.
different. And we'll see why in a moment.
Yes, you can also
yeah. But I mean, that seems to me, it seems to me a bit odd to characterize this as a property of the resonance itself. It's a property of where you are, as it were, in the sweep.
Yeah, well, you can say I am here very close and so on.
Okay, but anyway, we shouldn't, yeah.
People are using this term very widely, so. Yeah. If you try to re-educate them, they will object.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I'm afraid you're absolutely right. I'm sorry, I better speed up, since I seem to be nearly up to my hour, actually. So,
Tony, yeah. You continue.
Okay, I think we are getting to the more interesting bits here now, actually. Yeah, so, yeah. Okay. So, okay, now what's the physical significance of delta C, delta sub C? Well, it actually is a very simple answer to that question. Let's define the relative probability of finding our. Assume we're basically on the left hand side of the resonance, so that we do have a bound state. And that bound state is going to be partly in the open channel and partly in the closed channel. Let's define the relative probability of being in the closed channel relative to that in the open channel as lambda. Then it turns out we can actually work out an exact formula for lambda in terms of this. I won't go through the algebra unless anyone's particularly interested. But anyway, and then it comes out to have this rather simple expression here. So what delta C marks, lambda is the relative probability of being in the closed channel, okay, being with that particular pair of spins. Okay. So what delta C is physically marks is the value of the detuning at which the nature of the bound state switches over from being primarily in the open channel, which is what it was very close to the resonance, to being primarily in the closed channel. And the quantity xi sub c, which is related to m, which I think is what people usually call r star, apart from maybe a numerical factor, this has a very simple physical significance. It's basically the radius of the open channel component at the point where you make the crossover, right? And that is much larger than the radius of the closed channel state. So really, there's a pretty big qualitative change going on close to this point, because it's not a discontinuity, it's a smooth crossover, but still, I think it's fairly important qualitative change.
Crossover, you mean when the fraction is half up?
Yeah, yeah.
And in some different language, you could call it as the fraction of bare molecules in the breast molecular component?
Possibly, yeah. But you, well, yes, but, okay, I'm going, there's an important point which I'll come to on the next view graph, actually. We can draw this qualitative picture. So you see, here were the energy levels, the lowest energy level in the open channel, lowest energy in the closed channel, in the absence of any coupling between them. The effect of the coupling is first of all to shift the actual crossing point somewhat, that was our delta zero here, but also it qualitatively changes the behavior down here. Now you see delta C is exactly where you cross over from being mostly in the open channel to mostly in the closed channel. One point I want to emphasize rather strongly is the following. It's very tempting at first sight to think that you've got these two channels, so there's, as it were, a state sitting there in the closed channel, there's a state sitting there in the open channel, you're hybridizing them and therefore getting different weights. But that really isn't true. In the whole of this region here, the closed channel state doesn't really exist. And there is no solution which corresponds even approximately to having a state there. There's just the one state, which is primarily open channel in this regime. Okay? Yeah, fine. Well, that's what we, yeah, that was that calculation I did on the back at the last week. Yes.
So, can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
So if you're going to write down an order parameter, which I know is not what you're doing, right? Suppose that you're going to do that.
Yeah, we'll do that in a moment.
Oh, you will. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, so why don't we just go on to? Okay, now we get to the crunch, which is the Feshbach many body problem in the Feshbach resonance case. And now, I think right at the beginning, we do have to, at least in principle, make an important distinction, which I've tried to emphasize before, but I think has not been widely made in the literature, between the case where both the atomic states involved are different in the two channels and the case where one is common to the two channels. And I believe I'm correct in saying that most existing cases, if not all existing cases, are of type B. That is, you've got one of your two atomic states is essentially the same in the two channels. Okay, let's take case A first. Both the states are different. Well, then the two channels are really just equivalent to different values of K. So we can write a generalized BCS wave function which has the standard product form, the only difference being that for each value of K we have two different channels, one open, one closed, yeah? O for open, C for closed, okay? But apart from that, it has the standard BCS structure. We can then define an order parameter for the open channel, an order parameter for the closed channel. And all that happens is that we can basically get BCS gap equations, but they're now coupled between, in other words, delta in the open channel depends in principle on the pairing amplitude in the closed channel and vice versa.
What is delta C?
Delta C is the closed channel gap, in quotes. Okay?
What you call here closed channel gap is just the binding energy of the state in the closed channel, or what is?
No, it's got nothing to do with that. I mean, the binding energy of if I really take this picture seriously, to get an excitation in the closed channel, I would need to supply that large energy epsilon zero.
Yeah.
So that's not what I'm talking about here.
Okay.
Yeah, delta. I mean, I think it's better in some sense. That's why I like to work with F rather than delta. Because if delta, people tend to sort of think gap when they see delta, and that really isn't what we want to think here.
So what delta C is that in order to provide an excitation of the closed channel state, we have to apply a certain energy.
That's
subtract epsilon zero, and then you get delta C.
That wouldn't be quite right, because I think you're implicitly thinking of the BCS limit, and the closed channel is always way off the BCS limit.
So, totally. Yeah. Let me see if I understand. So suppose we agree the appropriate quantity would be F.
Yeah, let's forget about delta altogether.
If I were to express F in the BCS form, the usual BCS form, I can define delta through
there. True.
Is that what you mean by delta zero, delta C?
Yeah, absolutely. So they should really have K's on them, strictly speaking. Yeah. Okay, now, very important point. Let's assume that all the closed channel amplitudes, remember these are dimensionless quantities, okay? And they're typically of order one in the thermodynamic limit. Let's make the assumption that all these FCs are small compared to one, okay? Then, as we saw before, it's just a simple generalization of what we had before, anything involving the closed channel amplitude is just going to look exactly the same as if we're dealing with a Schrödinger wave function, right? So we can now eliminate the closed channel amplitude in exactly as in the many body problem. The only difference that we're going to find is that because we've failed to conserve the number of particles here, so we can't do the sort of standard Schrödinger normalization. We've got to do the usual BCS trick of introducing a chemical potential, mu, and then minimizing. So there's no energies, no eigen energy, which comes into the problem. What substitutes for it is twice the chemical potential here. So everything goes through, except that E is everywhere replaced by the chemical twice the chemical potential. And so we can just change it. We just take over our result from the last section, which is I've just replaced E here by 2 mu. Okay, I'll just get this equation here. That's one equation for AX. Now, I don't know what mu is. How am I going to find out? So this is basically, in rather heavy disguise, as it were, this is, well, I'm sorry, okay. This equation followed from just analyzing the short-range behavior. The open channel, so I've now eliminated the closed channel completely. The open channel gap equation is now a simple generalization of what it was for the one channel case. Okay, so it's just that equation here. So that's two equations that I have. And now I still need to know what the I still need to find what the chemical potential is. How am I going to do that? Okay, well, I need my third equation, which is the number conservation equation. But now I have to be careful, because the sum, remember, this sum is only over the open channel states, okay? So it actually should sum to the number in the open channel, which is not the total number in general. So I've got to...
Can you explain how we get 2 mu minus g over there?
2 mu minus delta. How I got that? Well, I simply took the... You remember I derived in the two-body Feshbach resonance case, I derived an equation for 1 over A S of E. I've simply argued that since the structure, as it were, at short distances, is exactly the same, I can, basically, in my Green's function derivation, I just replace the wave function by f of r, and it comes out. Okay, so that's the catch then, that I have to remember that the sum here will only give me the number in the open channel, and that's not, in general, the total number. So, however, it turns out there's really rather a simple trick, at least qualitatively, for coping with that. From the solution of the closed channel Schrödinger equation, we can actually get out what the value, the absolute number in the closed channel is. And it turns out that apart from a numerical factor, which I'm still not sure about because the factors of 4 pi and so forth coming in, it's given by this expression here, where you remember that xi c was the r star, if you like, was this characteristic radius of the open channel at the crossover. And delta over EF squared is the absolute value of this. Yeah. So now we can write this equation here. But since the number is just related to KF, we can introduce, I think it's quite useful, an effective Fermi wave vector here. And the complete effect of the closed channel is now simply taken into account by, well, two things. First of all, the expression you actually got for the scattering length, for the open channel scattering length, in the end was due to the presence of the closed channel, but you never had to mention that explicitly. Just said it goes as minus one of a delta, etc. Okay. But the second replacement is that you must replace your real starting Fermi momentum with this effective Fermi momentum given by this expression here. Okay. Now, so a number of people, I think, have made essentially equivalent observations to this, and Jason in particular has analysed how things change as you vary this. You see, it's this combination, KF times IC, which is going to be really critical to say whether this is an important correction or not. And this is, KF's IC is simply the square root of the parameter EF divided by delta C. So large values of KF times IC correspond to the narrow resonance, and small values correspond to the broad resonance. Okay. This is just a different notation for handling that. Okay, the simpler case is the broad resonance, where KF's IC is much less than 1, so or EF is much less than delta C. Physically, what does that mean?
IC is something which all other people
denote as R star. Okay, if I ever write this up, I'll call it R star. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. But But I write it, the reason I might write it in that form is that it reminds me that what it actually is physically is the radius of the open channel component when you, as you make the crossover to the closed channel. So suppose we're in the Borg resonance limit. Then you see that all the interesting action, remember that all the interesting action basically occurs when delta is of the order of EF, or much smaller, but certainly not much larger than that. And so all the interesting action then occurs in a regime where this renormalization is essentially negligible. So we can just keep the original KF. Now the only trace left of the closed channel is just the behavior of the S-wave scattering length, which is formally exactly what it was in the one-channel case, okay? So in this limit, and I agree with a conclusion, which I think that a lot of other people have independently come to, that in the interesting regime, when you're making the transition between the BCS limit and both condensated diatomic molecules, everything looks exactly like the one-channel case. If you go further away, if you go further down below the resonance, eventually, of course, you'll come to the point where your diatomic molecules are no longer mostly in the open channel, they've switched over to the closed channel. And then, of course, things will look really rather different, but all of that is happening well into the BEC region. So basically, in the interesting regime, everything looks exactly the same as in the one-channel case. In the opposite case, the narrow resonance, we could say some certain qualitative things. Well, that's, obviously, to get quantitative results, you'd have to do some computing, which I haven't done. So basically, you've got this transformation of Kf. Now, at any given value of mu, provided I've fixed my value of mu, then the value of a delta over EF is fixed uniquely by the gap equation. So, for example, at unitarity, we can immediately conclude from this argument that the characteristic energy scale is Kf to the 4/3 times this. Rather than kf squared, as it would be, so times h squared over 2m or whatever, rather than a kf squared. And I think that probably agrees with what other people found. One caution, there is one thing I have missed out in this whole discussion, which is the Hartree terms. Now, as I said, in the one-channel case, the Hartree terms are sort of trivial. You don't have to worry about them. In the it's not so obvious that they're going to be completely negligible in the many-body case, but I think at best what they're going to do, almost certainly, is just to introduce a slight density-dependent renormalization of this delta zero that occurs in the formula. I suspect that's true, but I haven't worked that out in detail at this point. Okay, now let's go on to the one thing which maybe is somewhat new in all of this, and that has to do with case B, which is where we have one atomic state which is common to the open and closed channels. Now, you can write the formula that you wrote before as a product of open channel and closed channel BCS-like functions, but when you do that, you find that your fourth term, in which you've got pairs forming in both channels, essentially is zero identically because the same state has been occupied twice. So in fact, what you've got, you end up with is this quantity here, and now you have a slightly different normalization condition here, you see. The potential, this doesn't affect basically the form of the potential energies, they just look the same as they always did in terms of the Fs. But if we introduce, what I meant by F open K, F open K is just UK times VK zero, F closed K is this here. Closed channel kinetic energy is now this form here, and you see that it involves a parameter coming from the open channel behavior. And the physical reason for that is very simple. It simply means that if I've already got a Cooper pair formed in the open channel and I've used a particular spin state with a particular value of K, then that state is no longer available to me for forming states in the closed channel. Okay. Now, what is the order of magnitude of these corrections? We can now only go through the exact elimination of the closed channel state if not only is FCK much less than one, but also this condition is true. If we were dealing with case A, the only thing that would be required is if CK is less than one, because remember they were completely uncoupled in that case. Okay? And for FCK to be much less than one, all you require is this condition here, which we essentially assumed. in R0 cubed, much less than 1. Okay? The distance between particles should be very large compared to the range of the potential. Okay? However, the second condition, namely that this is true, requires a much more stringent. Is much more stringent. It requires essentially this, where AS is. There's a bit of sloppy in my notation. It's basically the radius of the bound state in the open channel. Okay, and that's never satisfied sufficiently close to the unitarity. So now, do I have to worry a lot about this? Well, it turns out probably not, actually, for the following reason.
In order for F0 K to be ignored, you say we need to have NAS cubed much less than 1.
Crudely speaking, yes, yeah. Because remember that that's, if you're talking just about a simple potential resonance, that would be essentially the condition to have a tightly bound diatomic molecule and forget all about the Fermi statistics. No, you can. So this condition is never satisfied. But the question is, does that really matter very much? Probably not, actually, for the following reason. You have to remember that the only reason why you get this condition is that you have this very large open channel component. So it's really rather huge molecule. And for the K vectors, which are comparable to the inverse of that quantity and longer, that matters a lot. But it only matters for those. It doesn't matter for the shorter wave vectors. So although this is certainly true that it's certainly true that you sometimes have to take this into account, you really only have to do it seriously when K is small compared to, it's comparable to or smaller than AS to the minus 1. Let's say very crudely R star to the minus 1. So it's not going to have a major effect on the closed channel equation, but it's going to have some effect. And the question is, when is that effect going to be of order 1? Well, what do we mean by of order 1 here? I mean, clearly, it's never... as a result of these nonlinear effects, the equation for your closed channel state is going to be slightly modified from what it was in the Schrodinger case. And if we look at this as a sort of pseudo-Schrodinger problem, then what that means is the binding energy is going to be slightly shifted. Now, it's certainly not going to be shifted by anything at all comparable to its original value, okay? But that's not relevant. What we were interested in is it going to be shifted by an amount comparable to the smallest characteristic energy in our problem, which is delta C? And the condition for that to be the case is that EF over delta C has to be not only large compared to 1, but large compared to this quantity here. Okay? I think I'm correct in saying that this is not an obviously unattainable condition, and that in fact in the very narrowest resonances, you might well obtain that condition. So under those conditions, of course, we have to go back essentially to square one. We can no longer eliminate the closed channel state in the form we did. However, let me now let me just make one final remark just to confuse things further. Sorry?
This inequality, does it imply that the inequality for this correction is important?
Yeah.
The size of molecule has to be...
The size, that's a necessary condition. It's not clear that it's a sufficient one, actually. Yes, I think it has to be even larger than that. Because basically the statement that that at crossover, you see, when you're sufficiently close to the resonance, then the size of your bound state molecule is always arbitrarily large. So it's always large compared to KF to the minus 1. But the distinction between broad and narrow resonances was whether that's true at crossover or not. Okay. So that is a stronger condition, but it's still not all that strong because you've only got the one-third power occurring in here, and I think it's not, in principle, impossible to reach that that condition. Let me just finally confuse things further by remarking that I've sort of rather emphasised the fact that what I call case B, when you've got a common atomic state, makes extra difficulties, but in fact, although formally it makes sort of rather nasty extra difficulties, it's not clear that the absolute magnitude of the effect is any larger than in case A. For the following reason. In case B, you have this effect, which is of order 1, but it's only of order 1 for this very restricted range of wavelengths, very, very, very small k. Okay? In the case B, you've got an effect which is always small, but extends over the whole wavelength space. And it turns out, if you just put it, jot down the estimates, that to order of magnitude, the effect should be the same in case A and case B. At least when you have an appreciable closed channel component. If you're in the regime sufficiently close to the resonance where you don't have a large closed channel component, then only case A matters. Okay? Because basically the argument there is that the number of closed channel molecules is so thin that that any nonlinear effects must go away completely. Okay. So I think this is the only point in this talk where I've introduced anything which is perhaps in any way unknown. But I think this is an interesting point. Sorry?
It is very interesting. I think. I enjoy this enormously. I think for people who used to do calculation with dimensional regularizations, this is really the way to really open up all the high energy physics.
Well, then you can
see how things come out. So it's very nice. But the last part I have understood is it is an important issue about
I think it could be if we ever get to these conditions.
If I am in the case of the white Cashbach resonance,
what, where
yes. We believe that everything is universal and actually we are after that. is the resonance still shifted in the many body system compared to its value for two particles? I think it is.
Yes. It is. I think it is. It. Well. Okay. I need to think about that a moment. But yes, I think almost certainly you're right. But the shift would presumably be of the order of the Fermi energy or less. Most of the order of the Fermi energy, perhaps less than that.
So yeah. Does it mean that it's absolutely unimportant? Or
well, I mean, if you. Well, the thing is, you see, one can ask the formal question. Which is, at what point exactly does the Let me start again. You ask the question: is the resonance shifted? Now I can give you two formal statements. One is that the point at which the quantity which I have called AS, which is the hold on, I have to be careful how I do. No, okay.
Okay, I want
to understand. Okay. I think my difficulty in answering your question is that I have no clear definition of what I mean by the resonance in the many-body case. In the two-body case, I can say it's trivial. It's where the S-wave scattering length for the zero-energy state goes to infinity. In the many-body case, I can't, as it were, set that boundary condition. So I can't really identify where the resonance is, except by saying by definition it's at the two-body value. In the many-body case, let me just emphasize this point, although I've said it many times before. In the many-body case, the point at which the two-body resonance occurs is really irrelevant. Nothing special happens there. The only point you can identify as in any way special is the point at which the chemical potential crosses zero, which is not at the same point. It's further down. It's more on the BEC side.
Can we actually identify the Cashbach resonance in the many body case as the point where there is a divergence in the amplitude of a function or something?
I mean, perhaps as a theorist you could do that. The question is, can you get your experimental colleagues to measure it?
I don't care what they measure.
This is
news.
I mean, look. you could always. I mean, I'm sure you could find a formal definition, but I suspect in the last resort it would probably boil down to it's simply it's where it is in the two-body problem. As I don't think there are any special signatures in the many-body problem at that point.
So I have two questions. First one is your distinction in case A and case B.
Yes.
And the first part of the resonance involves a simultaneous sort of flip of a nucleus spin and an electronic spin.
They don't have to be on the same atom, but they can be, right? If they are on the. They don't have to be, but they can be, okay?
But they can be. So, yeah. Basically, I'm wondering this this pairing, this yep. operator, fermion operator, this alpha, beta, gamma.
Mm, yep.
These are f indexes for f.
Well, usually you're in the Paschen-Bach regime where f is not a good quantum number. But so I think you're just talking about s and ms and mri. Yeah.
Now, you see. Electron,
well, no, but you're right. I mean, let's think about a real case. Say potassium 40. Okay. So you start off with 9 halves minus 9 halves and 9 halves minus 7 halves. And then, if I'm not mistaken, the transition. Now, remember that actually, we should really be using a different name for these. You should say MS equals plus one or minus one. I forget. MS equals say plus one. MI equals minus 7 halves. Minus 8, 4, 4. Minus 4. Nuclear spin is even. Nuclear spin is even. Yeah. So minus 4. Okay. So you've got you've got two parallel electron spins, and you have one. Then one of your states is nuclear spin minus 4, and the other is nuclear spin minus 3. Okay. Now, as you say, you can now to get into the closed channel, you have to flip a nucleus and an electron. If you do it on the same atom, then obviously that's only changed one of the indices there. If I do it on different atoms, then of course in general I've changed both. But I would think that these same atom effects are likely to be at least as important, if not more so, in this case.
Yeah. I have a second question, which is I've had this question for actually quite some time. When you write this BCS pairing with you are summation index k here sums over all the continuum, or
well, it's a product actually, not a sum. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Well, the expression is kinetic energy.
But it's some kind of something. Mm. But we know that when you involve a resonance, this plane wave k is all complete. When I do a scattering,
well,
yes.
Yeah.
If I do two-body scattering, I mean, I should
sure.
use bound states plus the scattering states. I can never use. So somehow there's inconsistency.
No, I don't think so. You can make look. If I was just dealing with a simple Schrödinger, wave function, I can perfectly well expand it in plane wave states, even though it's actually a bound state.
But isn't this overcomplete?
No.
It's a complete basis, overcomplete for the system.
No, my basis, I can always take the free particle plane wave states, k minus k. I mean, I'm dealing with a two particle problem, so I want k and minus k, okay? And take that set of states as a complete set. And I can, if I want to, I can express my bound state wave function in terms of these. So I don't think I'm overcounting anywhere. Huh? About to take the microphone off now.
So,
yeah.
So, are there other questions?